a certain number of days along the quay, and if the owner found no goods to carry during that time, so much the worse for him, he had to depart with his empty barge to leave room for newcomers. Obstruction was thus avoided, even though the competition between the private owners of the boats continued to exist. Were the latter suppressed, the agreement would have been only the more cordial. It is unnecessary to add that the shipowners could adhere or not to the syndicate. That was their business, but most of them elected to join it. Moreover, these syndicates offered such great advantages that they spread also along the Rhine, the Weser, the Oder, and as far as Berlin. The boatmen did not wait for a great Bismarck to annex Holland to Germany and to appoint an Oberhauptgeneral Staatskanal Navigationsraft (Supreme Head Counselor of the General States Canal Navigation) with a number of gold stripes on his sleeves corresponding to the length of the title. They preferred coming to an international understanding. Besides, a number of shipowners whose sailing vessels ply between Germany and Scandinavia, as well as Russia, have also joined in syndicates in order to regulate traffic in the Baltic and to bring about a certain harmony in the chassé-croisé of vessels. These associations have sprung up freely, recruiting volunteer adherents, and have naught in common with governments. It is, however, more than probable that here too greater capital oppresses lesser. Maybe the syndicate has also a tendency to become a monopoly, especially where it receives the precious patronage of the state that surely did not fail to interfere with it. Let us not forget either that these syndicates represent associations whose members have only private interests at stake, and that if at the same time each shipowner were compelled by the socializing of production, consumption and exchange to belong to federated communes or to 100 other associations for the satisfying of his needs, things would have a different aspect. A group of shipowners powerful on sea would feel weak on land, and they would be obliged to lessen their claims in order to come to terms with railways, factories and other groups. At any rate, without discussing the future, here is another spontaneous association that has dispensed with government. Let us quote more examples. As we are talking of ships and boats, let us mention one of the most splendid organizations that the 19th century has brought forth, one of those we may with right be proud of, the English Lifeboat Association. It is known that every year more than 1,000 ships are wrecked on the shores of England. At sea, a good ship seldom fears a storm. It is near the coast that danger threatens. Rough seas that shatter her stern post, squalls that carry off her masts and sails, currents that render her unmanageable, reefs and sandbanks on which she runs aground. Even in olden times, when it was a custom among inhabitants of the coast to light fires in order to attract themselves onto reefs, in order to plunder their cargoes, they always strove to save a crew. Seeing a ship in distress, they launched their boats and went to the rescue of shipwrecked sailors, only too often finding a watery grave themselves. Every hamlet along the seashore has its legends of heroism, displayed by women as well as by men, to save crews in distress. No doubt the state and men of science have done something to diminish the number of casualties. Lighthouses, signals, charts, meteorological warnings have diminished them greatly. But there remains 1,000 ships and several thousand human lives to be saved every year. To this end, a few men of goodwill put their shoulders to the wheel. Being good sailors and navigators themselves, they invented a lifeboat that could weather a storm without being torn to pieces or capsizing, and they set to work to interest the public in their venture, to collect the necessary funds for constructing boats and for stationing them along the coast, wherever they could be of use. These men, not being Jacobins, did not turn to the government. They understood that to bring their enterprise to a successful issue, they must have the cooperation, the enthusiasm, the local knowledge, and especially the self-sacrifice of the local sailors. They also understood that to find men who at the first signal would launch their boat at night in a chaos of waves, not suffering themselves to be deterred by darkness or breakers, and struggling 5, 6, 10 hours against the tide before reaching a vessel in distress, men ready to risk their lives to save those of others, there must be a feeling of solidarity, a spirit of sacrifice, not to be bought with galloon. It was therefore a perfectly spontaneous movement, sprung from agreement and individual initiative. Hundreds of local groups arose along the coast. The initiators had the common sense not to pose as masters. They looked for sagacity in the fishermen's hamlets, and when a rich man sent £1,000 to a village on the coast to erect a lifeboat station and his offer was accepted, he left the choice of a site to the local fishermen and sailors. Models of new boats were not submitted to the Admiralty. We read in a report of the association As it is of importance that lifeboatmen should have full confidence in the vessel they man, the committee will make a point of constructing and equipping the boats according to the lifeboatmen's express wish. In consequence, every year brings with it new improvements. The work is wholly conducted by volunteers organizing in committees and local groups, by mutual aid and agreement. Oh, anarchists! Moreover, they ask nothing of the ratepayers, and in a year they may receive £40,000 in spontaneous subscriptions. As to the results, here they are. In 1891, the association possessed 293 lifeboats. The same year, it saved 601 shipwrecked sailors and 33 vessels. Since its foundation, it has saved 32,671 human beings. In 1886, three lifeboats, with all their men having perished at sea, hundreds of new volunteers entered their names, organized themselves into local groups, and the agitation resulted in the construction of 20 additional boats. As we proceed, let us note that every year the association sends to the fishermen and sailors excellent barometers at a price 3 times less than their sale price in private shops. It propagates meteorological knowledge and warns the parties concerned of the sudden changes of weather predicted by men of science. Let us repeat that these hundreds of committees and local groups are not organized hierarchically and are composed exclusively of volunteers, lifeboatmen and people interested in the work. The central committee, which is more of a center for correspondence, in no wise interferes. It is true that when a voting on some question of education or local taxation takes place in a district, these committees of the National Lifeboat Association do not, as such, take part in the deliberations, a modesty which unfortunately the members of elected bodies do not imitate. But on the other hand, these brave men do not allow those who have never faced a storm to legislate for them about saving life. At the first signal of distress, they rush to their boats and go hide. There are no embroidered uniforms, but much goodwill. Let us take another society of the same kind, that of the Red Cross. The name matters little. Let us examine it. Imagine somebody saying 50 years ago, the state, capable as it is of massacring 20,000 men in a day and of wounding 50,000 more, is incapable of helping its own victims. Consequently, as long as war exists, private initiative must intervene, and men of goodwill must organize internationally for this human work. What mockery would not have met the men who would have dared to speak thus? To begin with, he would have been called a utopian, and if that did not silence him, he would have been told, "What nonsense! Your volunteers will be found wanting precisely where they are most needed. Your volunteer hospitals will be centralized in a safe place, while everything will be wanting in the ambulances. Utopians like you forget the national rivalries which will cause the poor soldiers to die without any help." Such disheartening remarks would have only been equaled by the number of speakers. Who of us has not heard men hold forth in this strain? Now we know what happened. Red Cross societies organize themselves freely everywhere in all countries, in thousands of localities, and when the war of 1872-1 broke out, the volunteers set to work, men and women offered their services, thousands of hospitals and ambulances were organized, trains were started carrying ambulances, provisions, linen and medicaments for the wounded. The English committee sent entire convoys of food, clothing, tools, grain to sow, beasts of drought, even steam plough, with their attendants to help in the tillage of departments devastated by the war. Only consult La Croix Rouge by Gustave Moigny, and you will be really struck by the immensity of the work performed. As to the prophets ever ready to deny other men's courage, good sense and intelligence, and believing themselves to be the only ones capable of ruling the world with a rod, none of their predictions were realized. The devotion of the Red Cross volunteers was beyond all praise. They were only too eager to occupy the most dangerous posts. And whereas the salaried doctors of the Napoleonic state fled with their staff when the Prussians approached, the Red Cross volunteers continued their work under fire. And during the brutalities of Bismarck's and Napoleon's officers, lavishing their care on the wounded of all nationalities, Dutch, Italians, Swedes, Belgians, even Japanese and Chinese agreed remarkably well. They distributed their hospitals and their ambulances according to the needs of the occasion. They vied with one another, especially in the hygiene of their hospitals. And there is many a Frenchman who still speaks with deep gratitude of the tender care he received from the Dutch or German volunteers in the Red Cross ambulances. But what is this to an authoritarian? His ideal is the regiment doctor, salaried by the state. What does he care for the Red Cross and its hygienic hospitals if the nurses be not functionaries? Here is then an organization, sprung up but yesterday, and which reckons its members by hundreds of thousands, possesses ambulances, hospital trains, elaborates new processes for treating wounds, and so on, and is due to the spontaneous initiative of a few devoted men. Perhaps we shall be told that the state has something to do with this organization. Yes, states have laid hands on it to seize it. The directing committees are presided over by those whom flunkies call princes of the blood. Emperors and queens lavishly patronize the national committees. But it is not to this patronage that the success of the organization is due. It is to the thousand local committees of each nation, to the activity of individuals, to the devotion of all those who try to help the victims of war. And this devotion would be far greater if the state did not meddle with it. In any case, it was not by the order of an international directing committee that Englishmen and Japanese, Swiss and Chinamen, bestirred themselves to send help to the wounded in 1871. It was not by order of an international ministry that hospitals rose on the invaded territory and that ambulances were carried on to the battlefield. It was by the initiative of volunteers from each country. Once on the spot, they did not get hold of one another by the hair, as was foreseen by the Jacobinists of all nations. They all set to work without distinction of nationality. We may regret that such great efforts should be put to the service of so bad a cause, and we may ask ourselves, like the poet Chal, why inflict wounds if you are to heal them afterwards? In striving to destroy the power of capitalist and middle-class authority, we work to put an end to the massacres called wars, and we would further rather see the Red Cross volunteers put forth their activity to bring about, the suppression of war, but we had to mention this immense organization as another illustration of results produced by free agreement and free aid. If we wish to multiply examples taken from the art of exterminating men, we should never end. Suffice to quote the numerous societies to which the German army owes its force, that does not only depend on discipline as is generally believed. I mean the societies whose aim is to propagate military knowledge. At one of the last congresses of the Military Alliance, Craigieburn, delegates from 2,452 federated societies comprising 151,712 members were present, but there are besides very numerous shooting, military games, strategical games, topographical studies societies. These are the workshops in which the technical knowledge of the German army is developed, not in regimental schools. It is a formidable network of all kinds of societies, including military men and civilians, geographers and gymnasts, sportsmen and technologists, which rise up spontaneously, organize, federate, discuss and explore the country. It is these voluntary and free associations that go to make the real backbone of the German army. Their aim is execrable. It is the maintenance of the empire. But what concerns us is to point out that, in spite of military organization being the great mission of the state, success in this branch is the more certain the more it is left to the free agreement of groups and to the free initiative of individuals. Even in matters pertaining to war, free agreement is thus appealed to. And to further prove our assertion, let us mention the Volunteer Topographers Corps of Switzerland, who study in detail the mountain passages, the Aeroplane Corps of France, the 300,000 British volunteers, the British National Artillery Association, and the society now in course of organization for the defense of England's coast, as well as the appeals made to the commercial fleet, the bicyclist corps, and the new organizations of private motor cars and steam launches. Everywhere the state is abdicating and abandoning its holy functions to private individuals. Everywhere free organization trespasses on its domain. And yet the facts we have quoted give us only a glimpse of what free government has in store for us in the future, when there will be no more state. Chapter 12, Objections, Part 1. Let us now examine the principal objections put forth against communism. Most of them are evidently caused by a simple misunderstanding, yet they raise important questions and merit our attention. It is not for us to answer the objections raised by authoritarian communism. We ourselves hold with them. Civilized nations have suffered too much in the long, hard struggle for the emancipation of the individual to disown their past work and to tolerate a government that would make itself felt in the smallest details of a citizen's life, even if that government had no other aim than the good of the community. Should an authoritarian socialist society ever succeed in establishing itself, it could not last. General discontent would soon force it to break up or to reorganize itself on principles of liberty. It is of an anarchist communist society we are about to speak, a society that recognizes the absolute liberty of the individual, that does not admit of any authority, and makes use of no compulsion to drive men to work. Limiting our studies to the economic side of the question, let us see if such a society, composed of men as they are today, neither better nor worse, neither more nor less industrious, would have a chance of successful development. The objection is known. If the existence of each is guaranteed, and if the necessity of earning wages does not compel men to work, nobody will work. Every man will lay the burden of his work on another, if he is not forced to do it himself. Let us first note the incredible levity with which this objection is raised, without even realizing that the real question raised by this objection is merely to know, on the one hand, whether you effectively obtain by wage work the results that are said to be obtained, and on the other hand, whether voluntary work is not already now more productive than work stimulated by wages. A question which, to be dealt with properly, would require a serious study. But whereas in exact sciences men give their opinion on subjects infinitely less important and less complicated, after serious research, after carefully collecting and analyzing facts, on this question we will pronounce judgment without appeal, resting satisfied with any one particular event, such as, for example, the want of success of some communist association in America. They act like the barrister who does not see in the council, for the opposite side, a representative of a cause or an opinion contrary to his own, but a simple nuisance, an adversary in an oratorical debate. And if he be lucky enough to find a repartee, does not otherwise care to justify his cause. Therefore, the study of this essential basis of all political economy, the study of the most favorable conditions for giving society the greatest amount of useful products with the least waste of human energy, does not advance. People either limit themselves to repeating commonplace assertions, or else they pretend ignorance of our assertions. What is most striking in this levity is that even in capitalist political economy, you already find a few writers compelled by facts to doubt the axiom put forth by the founders of their science, that the threat of hunger is man's best stimulant for productive work. They begin to perceive that in production a certain collective element is introduced, which has been too much neglected up till now, and which might be more important than personal gain. The inferior quality of wage work, the terrible waste of human energy in modern agricultural and industrial labor, the ever-growing quantity of pleasure seekers who shift their burden onto other shoulders, the absence of a certain animation in production that is becoming more and more apparent, all this is beginning to preoccupy the economists of the classical school. Some of them ask themselves if they have not got on the wrong track, if the imaginary evil being that was supposed to be tempted exclusively by a bit of luck or wages really exists. This heresy penetrates even into universities. It is found in books of orthodox economy. But this does not prevent a great many socialist reformers from remaining partisans of individual remuneration and defending the old citadel of wagedom, notwithstanding that it is being delivered over stone by stone to the assailants by its former defenders. They fear that without compulsion, the masses will not work. But during our own lifetime, have we not heard the same fears expressed twice? Once by the anti-abolitionists in America, before the emancipation of the Negroes, and for a second time by the Russian nobility before the liberation of the serfs. Without the whip, the Negro will not work, said the anti-abolitionists. Free from their master's supervision, the serfs will leave the fields uncultivated, said the Russian serf owners. It was the refrain of a French nobleman in 1789, the refrain of the Middle Ages, a refrain as old as the world, and we shall hear it every time there is a question of sweeping away an injustice, and each time actual facts give it the lie. The liberated peasant of 1792 bluffed with an eager energy unknown to his ancestors. The emancipated Negro works more than his fathers, and the Russian peasant, after having honored the honeymoon of his emancipation by celebrating Fridays as well as Sundays, has taken up work with an eagerness proportionate to the completeness of his liberation. There, where the soil is his, he works desperately. That is the exact word for it. The anti-abolitionist refrain can be of value to slave owners as to the slaves themselves. They know what it is worth, as they know its motive. Moreover, who but the economists themselves taught us that while a wage earner's work is very often indifferent, an intense and productive work is only obtained from a man who sees his wealth increase in proportion to his efforts. All hymns sung in honor of private property can be reduced to this axiom. For it is remarkable that when economists, wishing to celebrate the blessings of property, show us how an unproductive, marshy or stony soil is clothed with rich harvests when cultivated by the peasant proprietor. They in no wise prove their thesis in favor of private property. By admitting that the only guarantee not to be robbed of the fruits of your labor is to possess the instruments of labor, which is true, the economists only prove that man really produces most when he works in freedom, when he has a certain choice in his occupations, when he has no overseer to impede him, and lastly, when he sees his work bringing in a profit to him and to others who work like him, but bringing in little to idlers. Nothing else can be deducted from their argumentation, and this is what we maintain ourselves. As to the form of possession of the instruments of labor, the economists only mention it indirectly in their demonstration, as a guarantee to the cultivator that he shall not be robbed of the profits of his yield, nor of his improvements. Besides, in support of their thesis in favor of private property against all other forms of possession, should not the economists demonstrate that under the form of communal property, land never produces such rich harvest as when the possession is private? But this they could not prove. In fact, it is the contrary that has been observed. Take for example a commune in the canton of Vaud, in the winter time, when all the men of the village go to fell wood in the forest, which belongs to them all. It is precisely during these festivals of labor that the greatest order for work and the most considerable display of human energy are apparent. No salaried labor, no effort of a private owner can bear comparison with it. Or let us take a Russian village, when all its inhabitants mow a field belonging to the commune, or farm by it. There you will see what man can produce when he works in common for communal production. Comrades vie with one another in cutting the wider swath. Women bestir themselves in their wake so as not to be distanced by the mowers. It is a festival of labor in which 100 people accomplish in a few hours a work that would not have been finished in a few days had they worked separately. What a miserable contrast compared to them is offered by the work of the isolated owner. In fact, we might quote scores of examples among the pioneers of America, in Swiss, German, Russian, and in certain French villages, or the work done in Russia by gangs, (artels) of masons, carpenters, boatmen, fishermen, etc., who undertake a task and divide the produce of the remuneration among themselves, without it passing through an intermediary of middlemen, or else the amount of work I saw performed in English shipyards when their remuneration was paid on the same principle. We could also mention the great communal huts of nomadic tribes, and an infinite number of successful collective enterprises, and in every case, we could show the unquestionable superiority of communal work compared to that of the wage earner or the isolated private owner. Well-being, that is to say the satisfaction of physical, artistic and moral needs, has always been the most powerful stimulant to work, and where a hireling hardly succeeds to produce the bare necessities with difficulty, a free worker, who sees ease and luxury increasing for him and for others in proportion to his efforts, spends infinitely far more energy and intelligence, and obtains products in a far greater abundance. The one feels riveted to misery, the other hopes for ease and luxury in the future. In this lies the whole secret. Therefore, a society aiming at the well-being of all, and at the possibility of all enjoying life in all its manifestations, will give voluntary work, which will be infinitely superior, and yield far more than work has produced up till now under the good of slavery, serfdom or wagedom. Part 2. Nowadays, whoever can load on others his share of labor indispensable to existence does so, and it is believed that it will always be so. Now, work indispensable to existence is essentially manual. We may be artists or scientists, but none of us can do without things obtained by manual work: bread, clovers, rods, roads, ships, light, heat, etc. And moreover, however highly artistic or however subtly metaphysical are our pleasures, they all depend on manual labor, and it is precisely this labor, the basis of life, that everyone tries to avoid. We understand perfectly well that it must be so nowadays, because to do manual work now means in reality to shut yourself up for 10 or 12 hours a day in an unhealthy workshop and to remain chained to the same task for 20 or 30 years and maybe for your whole life. It means to be doomed to a paltry wage, to the uncertainty of the morrow, to want of work, often to destitution, more often than not to death in a hospital, after having worked 40 years to feed, clothe, amuse and instruct others than yourself and your children. It means to bear the stamp of inferiority all your life, because whatever the politicians tell us, the manual worker is always considered inferior to the brain worker, and the one who has toiled 10 hours in a workshop has not the time and still less the means to give himself the high delights of science and art, nor even to prepare himself to appreciate them. He must be content with the crumbs from the table of privileged persons. We understand that under these conditions, manual labor is considered a curse of fate. We understand that all men have but one dream, that of emerging from, or enabling their children to emerge from this inferior state, to create for themselves an independent position, which means what? To also live by other men's work. As long as there will be a class of manual workers and a class of brain workers, black hands and white hands, it will be thus. What interest, in fact, can this depressing work have for the worker, when he knows that the fate awaiting him from the cradle to the grave will be to live in mediocrity, poverty, and insecurity of the morrow? Therefore, when we see the immense majority of men take up their wretched task every morning, we feel surprised at their perseverance, at their zeal for work, at the habit that enables them, like machines, blindly obeying an impetus given, to lead this life of misery without hope for the morrow, without foreseeing ever so vaguely that some day they, or at least their children, will be part of a humanity rich in all the treasures of a bountiful nature, in all the enjoyments of knowledge, scientific and artistic creation, reserved today to a few privileged favorites. It is precisely to put an end to this separation between manual and brain work that we want to abolish wagedom, that we want the social revolution. Then work will no longer appear a curse of fate. It will become what it should be, the free exercise of all the faculties of man. Moreover, it is time to submit to a serious analysis this legend about superior work, supposed to be obtained under the lash of wagedom. It would be sufficient to visit not the model factory and workshop that we find now and again, but a number of our ordinary factories, to conceive the immense waste of human energy that characterizes modern industry. For one factory, more or less rationally organized, there are 100 or more which waste man's labor without any more substantial motive than that of perhaps bringing in a few pounds more per day to the employer. Here you see youths from 20 to 25 years of age, sitting all day long on a bench, their chests sunken in, feverishly shaking their heads and bodies, to tie with the speed of conjurers the 2 ends of worthless scraps of cotton, the refuse of the lace looms. What progeny will these trembling and rickety bodies bequeath to their country? But they occupy so little room in the factory, and each of them brings me in 6 pence net every day, will say the employer. In an immense London factory we saw girls, bald at 17 from carrying trays of matches on their heads from one room to another, when the simplest machine could wheel the matches to their tables. But it costs so little the work of women who have no special trade. Why should we use a machine? When these can do no more, they will be easily replaced. There are so many of them in the street. On the steps of a mansion on an icy night, you will find a barefooted child asleep with its bundle of papers in its arms. Child labor costs so little that it may be well employed every evening to sell 10 pence worth of papers, of which the poor boy will receive a penny or a penny halfpenny. And continually in all big cities you may see robust men tramping about who have been out of work for months, while their daughters grow pale in the overheated vapors of the workshops for dressing stuffs, and their sons are filling blacking pots by hand, or spend those years during which they ought to have learned a trade in carrying about baskets for a greengrocer, and at the age of 18 or 20 become regular unemployed. And so it is everywhere, from San Francisco to Moscow, and from Naples to Stockholm. The waste of human energy is the distinguishing and predominant trait of our industry, not to mention trade, where it attains still more colossal proportions. What a sad satire is that name, political economy, given to the science of waste and energy under the system of wagedom. This is not all. If you speak to the director of a well-organized factory, he will naively explain to you that it is difficult nowadays to find a skillful, vigorous and energetic workman who works with a will. Should such a man present himself among the 20 or 30 who call every Monday asking us for work, he is sure to be received, even if we are reducing the number of our hands. We recognize him at the first glance, and he is always accepted, even though we have to get rid of an older and less active worker the next day. And the one who has just received notice to quit, and all those who will receive it tomorrow, go to reinforce that immense reserve army of capital, workmen out of work, who are only called to the loom or the bench when there is pressure of work, or to oppose strikers. And those others, the average workers who are sent away by the better class factories as soon as business is slackened, they also join the formidable army of aged and indifferent workers who continually circulate among the second class factories, those which barely cover their expenses and make their way in the world by trickery and snares laid for the buyer, and especially for the consumer in distant countries. And if you talk to the workmen themselves, you will soon learn that the rule in such factories is never to do your best. Shoddy pay, shoddy work. This is the advice which the working man receives from his comrades upon entering such a factory. For the workers know that if in a moment of generosity they give way to the entreaties of an employer and consent to intensify the work in order to carry out a pressing order, this nervous work will be exacted in the future as a rule in the scale of wages. Therefore, in all such factories, they prefer never to produce as much as they can. In certain industries, production is limited so as to keep up high prices, and sometimes the password "Gokeni" is given, which signifies bad work for bad pay. Wage work is tough work. It cannot, it must not produce all that it could produce. And it is high time to disbelieve the legend which represents wagedom as the best incentive to productive work. If industry nowadays brings in 100 times more than it did in the days of our grandfathers, it is due to the sudden awakening of physical and chemical sciences towards the end of last century, not to the capitalist organization of wagedom, but in spite of that organization. Part 3. Those who have seriously studied the question do not deny any of the advantages of communism, on condition, be it well understood, that communism be perfectly free, that is to say anarchist. They recognize that work paid with money, even disguised under the name of labor checks, to workers' associations governed by the state, would keep up the characteristics of wagedom and would retain its disadvantages. They agree that the whole system would soon suffer from it, even if society came into possession of the instruments of production. And they admit that thanks to an integral, complete education given to all children, to the laborious habits of civilized societies, with the liberty of choosing and varying their occupations, and the attractions of work done by equals for the well-being of all, a communist society would not be wanting in producers, who would soon make the fertility of the soil triple and tenfold, and give a new impulse to industry. This our opponents agree to. But the danger, they say, will come from that minority of loafers who will not work and will not have regular habits, in spite of the excellent conditions that would make work pleasant. Today, the prospect of hunger compels the most refractory to move along with the others. The one who does not arrive in time is dismissed, but one black sheep suffices to contaminate the whole flock, and two or three sluggish or refractory workmen would lead the others astray and bring a spirit of disorder and rebellion to the workshop that would make work impossible, so that in the end we should have to return to a system of compulsion that would force such foreign leaders back into the ranks. And then, is not the system of wages paid in proportion to work performed the only one that enables compulsion to be employed without hurting the feelings of independence of the worker? All other means would imply the continual intervention of an authority that would be repugnant to freemen. This, we believe, is the objection fairly stated. To begin with, such an objection belongs to the category of arguments which try to justify the state, the penal law, the judge, and the ruler. As they are people, a feeble minority, who will not submit to social customs, the authoritarians say, we must maintain magistrates, tribunals, and prisons, although these institutions become a source of new evils of all kinds. Therefore, we can only repeat what we have so often said concerning authority in general. To avoid a possible evil, you have recourse to means which in themselves are a greater evil, and become the source of those same abuses that you wish to remedy. For do not forget that it is wagedom, the impossibility of living otherwise than by selling your labor, which has created the present capitalist system, whose vices you begin to recognize. Besides, this way of reasoning is merely a sophistical justification of the evils of the present system. Wagedom was not instituted to remove the disadvantages of communism. Its origin, like that of the state and private ownership, is to be found elsewhere. It is born of slavery and serfdom imposed by force, and only wears a more modern garb. Thus the argument in favor of wagedom is as valueless as those by which they seek to apologize for private property and the state. We are nevertheless going to examine the objection and see if there is any truth in it. First of all, is it not evident that if a society founded on the principle of free work were really menaced by loafers, it could protect itself without the authoritarian organization we have nowadays, and without having recourse to wagedom. Let us take a group of volunteers, combining for some particular enterprise. Having its success at heart, they all work with a will, save one of the associates, who is frequently absent from his post. Must they on his account dissolve the group, elect a president to impose fines, and work out a code of penalties? It is evident that neither the one nor the other will be done, but that some day the comrade who imperils their enterprise will be told, "Friend, we should like to work with you, but as you are often absent from your post and you do your work negligently, we must part. Go and find other comrades who will put up with your indifference." This way is so natural that it is practiced everywhere, even nowadays in all industries, in competition with all possible systems of fines, docking of wages, supervision, etc. A workman may enter the factory at the appointed time, but if he does his work badly, if he hinders his comrades by his laziness or other defects, if he is quarrelsome, there is an end of it. He is compelled to leave the workshop. Authoritarians pretend that it is the almighty employer and his overseers who maintain regularity and quality of work in factories. In reality, in every somewhat complicated enterprise, in which the goods produced pass through many hands before being finished, it is the factory itself, the workmen as a unity, who see to the good quality of the work. Therefore, the best factories of British private industry have few overseers, far less on an average than the French factories, and less than the British state factories. A certain standard of public morals is maintained in the same way. Authoritarians say it is due to rural guards, judges and policemen, whereas in reality it is maintained in spite of judges, policemen and rural guards. Many of the laws producing criminals were said long ago. Not only in industrial workshops do things go on this way. It happens everywhere, every day on a scale that only bookworms have as yet no notion of. When a railway company, federated with other companies, fails to fulfill its engagements, when its trains are late and goods lie neglected at the stations, the other companies threaten to cancel the contract, and that threat usually suffices. It is generally believed, at any rate it is taught in state-approved schools, that commerce only keeps to its engagements from fear of lawsuits. Nothing of the sort. 9 times in 10, the trader who has not kept his word will not appear before a judge. There, where trade is very active, as in London, the sole fact of having driven a creditor to bring a lawsuit suffices for an immense majority of merchants to refuse for good to have any dealings with a man who has compelled one of them to go to law. This being so, why should means that are used today among workers in the workshop, traders in the trade, and railway companies in the organization of transport not be made use of in a society based on voluntary work? Take for example an association stipulating that each of its members should carry out the following contract. We undertake to give you the use of our houses, stores, streets, means of transport, schools, museums, etc., on condition that from 20 to 45 or 50 years of age, you consecrate 4 or 5 hours a day to some work recognized as necessary to existence. Choose yourself the producing groups which you wish to join, or organize a new group, provided that it will undertake to produce necessaries. And as for the remainder of your time, combine together with whomsoever you like, for recreation, art or science, according to the bent of your taste. 1,200 or 1,500 hours of work a year in one of the groups producing food, clothes or houses, or employed in public sanitation, transport and so on, is all we ask of you. For this amount of work we guarantee to you a free use of all that these groups produce or will produce. But if not one of the thousands of groups of our federation will receive you, whatever be their motive, if you are absolutely incapable of producing anything useful, or if you refuse to do it, then live like an isolated man or like an invalid. If we are rich enough to give you the necessaries of life, we shall be delighted to give them to you. You are a man and you have a right to live. But as you wish to live under special conditions and leave the ranks, it is more than probable that you will suffer for it in your daily relations with other citizens. You will be looked upon as a ghost of bourgeois society, unless some friend of yours, discovering you to be a talent, kindly free you from all moral obligation towards society by doing all the necessary work for you. And finally, if it does not please you, go and look for other conditions elsewhere in the wide world, or else seek adherence and organize with them on novel principles. We prefer our own. This is what could be done in a communal society in order to turn away sluggards if they became too numerous. Part 4. We very much doubt that we need fear this contingency in a society really based on the entire freedom of the individual. In fact, in spite of the premium on idleness offered by the private ownership of capital, the really lazy man is comparatively rare. unless his laziness be due to illness. Among workmen, it is often said that the bourgeois are idlers. There are certainly enough of them, but they too are the exception. On the contrary, in every industrial enterprise, you are sure to find one or more bourgeois who work very hard. It is true that the majority of bourgeois profit by their privileged position to award themselves the least unpleasant tasks, and that they work under hygienic conditions of air, food, etc., which permits them to do their business without too much fatigue. But these are precisely the conditions which we claim for all workers, without exception. It must also be said that if, thanks to their privileged position, rich people often perform absolutely useless or even harmful work in society, nevertheless the ministers, heads of departments, factory owners, traders, bankers, etc., subject themselves for a number of hours every day to work which they find more or less tiresome, or preferring their hours of leisure to this obligatory work. And if in 9 cases out of 10 this work is a harmful work, they find it none the less tiring for it. But it is precisely because the middle class put forth a great energy, even in doing harm, knowingly or not, and defending their privileged position, that they have succeeded in defeating the landed nobility, and that they continue to rule the masses. If they were idlers, they would long since have ceased to exist, and would have disappeared like the aristocracy. In a society that would expect only 4 or 5 hours a day of useful, pleasant, and hygienic work, these same middle-class people would perform their tasks perfectly well, and they certainly would not put up with the horrible conditions in which men toil nowadays without reforming them. If a Huxley spent only 5 hours in the sewers of London, rest assured that he would have found the means of making them as sanitary as his physiological laboratory. As to the laziness of a great majority of workers, only philistine economists and philanthropists can utter such nonsense. If you ask an intelligent manufacturer, he will tell you that if workmen only put it into their heads to be lazy, all factories would have to be closed. For no measure of severity, no system of spying would be of any use. You should have seen the terror caused in 1887 among British employers when a few agitators started preaching the Go Kenny theory. Bad pay, bad work. Take it easy, do not overwork yourselves, and waste all you can. They demoralize the worker. They want to kill our industry, cried those same people who the day before inveighed against the immorality of the worker and the bad quality of his work. But if the workers were what they are represented to be, namely the idler whom the employer is supposed continually to threaten with dismissal from the workshop, what would the word demoralization signify? So when we speak of possible idlers, we must well understand that it is a question of a small minority in society. And before legislating for that minority, would it not be wise to study the origin of that idleness? Whoever observes with an intelligent eye sees well enough that the child reputed lazy at schools is often the one which simply does not understand, because he is being badly taught. Very often too, it is suffering from cerebral anemia caused by poverty and an anti-hygienic education. A boy who is lazy at Greek or Latin would work admirably were he taught science, especially if he were taught with the aid of manual labor. A girl who is stupid at mathematics becomes the first mathematician of her class if she by chance meets somebody who can explain to her the elements of arithmetic which she did not understand. And a workman lazy in the workshop cultivates his garden at dawn while gazing at the rising sun, and will be at work again at nightfall, when all nature goes to its rest. Somebody has said that dust is matter in the wrong place. The same definition applies to 9/10 of those called lazy. They are people gone astray in a direction that does not answer to their temperament nor to their capacities. In reading the biography of great men, we are struck with the number of idlers among them. They were lazy so long as they had not found the right path. Afterwards, they became laborious to excess. Darwin, Stephenson, and many others belong to this category of idlers. Very often the idler is but a man to whom it is repugnant to spend all his life making the 18th part of a pin or the 100th part of a watch, while he feels he has exuberant energy which he would like to expend elsewhere. Often too, he is a rebel who cannot submit to being fixed all his life to a workbench in order to procure 1,000 pleasures for his employer, while knowing himself to be far the less stupid of the two, and knowing his only fault to be that of having been born in a hovel instead of coming into the world in a castle. Lastly, an immense number of idlers are idlers because they do not know well enough the trade by which they are compelled to earn their living. Seeing the imperfect thing they make with their own hands, striving vainly to do better, and perceiving that they never will succeed on account of the bad habits of work already acquired, they begin to hate their trade, and not knowing any other, hate work in general. Thousands of workmen and artists who are failures suffer from this cause. On the other hand, he who since his youth has learned to play the piano well, to handle the plane well, the chisel, the brush, or the file, so that he feels that what he does is beautiful, will never give up the piano, the chisel, or the file. He will find pleasure in his work, which does not tire him, so long as he is not overdriven. Under the one name, idleness, a series of results due to different causes have been grouped, of which each one could be a source of good, instead of being a source of evil to society. Like all questions concerning criminality and related to human faculties, facts have been collected having nothing in common with one another. People speak of laziness or crime without giving themselves the trouble to analyze the cause. They are in a hurry to punish these faults without inquiring if the punishment itself does not contain a premium on laziness or crime. Open footnote. Kropotkin in Russian and French prisons, London, 1887. Close footnote. This is why a free society, if it saw the number of idlers increasing in its midst, would no doubt think of looking first for the cause of laziness in order to suppress it before having recourse to punishment. When it is a case, as we have already mentioned, of simple bloodlessness, then before stuffing the brain of a child with science, nourish his system so as to produce blood, strengthen him, and that he shall not waste his time, take him to the country or to the seaside. There teach him in the open air, not in books, geometry by measuring the distance to a spire or the height of a tree, natural sciences while picking flowers and fishing in the sea, physical science while bidding the boat he will go to fish in. But for mercy's sake, do not fill his brain with classical sentences and dead languages. Do not make an idler of him. Oh, here is a child which has never order nor regular habits. Let the children first inculcate order among themselves, and later on, the laboratory, the workshop, the work that will have to be done in a limited space, with many tools about, under the guidance of an intelligent teacher, will teach them method. But do not make disorderly beings out of them by your school, whose only order is the symmetry of its benches, and which true image of the chaos in its teachings will never inspire anybody with a love of harmony, of consistency and method in work. Do not you see that by your methods of teaching, framed by a ministry for 8 million scholars who represent 8 million different capacities, you only impose a system good for mediocrities, conceived by an average of mediocrities? Your school becomes a university of laziness, as your prison is a university of crime. Make the school free, abolish your university grades, appeal to the volunteers of teaching. Begin that way, instead of making laws against laziness, which only serve to increase it. Give the workman who cannot condemn himself to make all his life a minute particle of some object, which stifles at his little tipping machine, which he ends by loving. Give him the chance of tilling the soil, of felling trees in the forest, sailing the seas in the teeth of a storm, dashing through space on an engine. But do not make an idler of him by forcing him all his life to attend to a small machine, to plow off the head of a screw, or to drill the eye of a needle. Suppress the cause of idleness, and you may take it for granted that few individuals will really hate work, especially voluntary work, and that there will be no need to manufacture a code of laws on their account. Chapter 13. The Collectivist Wages System. Part 1. In their plans for the reconstruction of society, the collectivists commit, in our opinion, a twofold error. While speaking of abolishing capitalist rule, they intend nevertheless to retain two institutions which are the very basis of this rule, representative government and the wages system. As regards so-called representative government, we have often spoken about it. It is absolutely incomprehensible to us that intelligent men, and such are not wanting in the collectivist party, can remain partisans of national or municipal parliaments after all the lessons history has given them. In France, in England, in Germany, or in the United States, while we see parliamentary rule breaking up, and from all sides criticism of its rule growing louder, not only of its results, but also of its principles, how is it that the revolutionary socialists defend a system already condemned to die, built up by the middle classes to hold their own against royalty, sanctioning and at the same time strengthening their sway over the workers? Parliamentary rule is preeminently a middle class rule. The upholders of this system have never seriously maintained that a parliament or a municipal council represent a nation or a city. The most intelligent among them know that this is impossible. The middle classes have simply used the parliamentary system to raise a protecting barrier against the pretensions of royalty, without giving the people liberty. But gradually, as the people become conscious of their real interests, and the variety of their interests is growing, the system can no longer work. Therefore, democrats of all countries vainly imagine various palliatives. The referendum is tried and found to be a failure. Proportional representation is spoken of, the representation of minorities and other parliamentary utopias. In a word, they strive to find what is not to be found, and after each new experiment, they are bound to recognize that it was a failure. So that confidence in representative government vanishes more and more. It is the same with the wages system, because once the abolition of private property is proclaimed, and the possession in common of all means of production is introduced, how can the wages system be maintained in any form? This is nevertheless what collectivists are doing when they recommend the use of the labor checks as a mode of remuneration for labor accomplished for the great collectivist employer, the state. It is easy to understand why the early English socialists, since the time of Robert Owen, came to the system of labor checks. They simply tried to make capital and labor agree. They repudiated the idea of laying hands on capitalist property by means of revolutionary measures. It is also easy to understand why Proudhon took up later on the same idea. In his mutualist system, he tried to make capital less offensive, notwithstanding the retaining of private property, which he detested from the bottom of his heart, but which he believed to be necessary to guarantee individuals against the state. Neither is it astonishing that certain economists, more or less bourgeois, admit labor checks. They care little whether the worker is paid in labor notes or in coin stamp with the effigy of the republic or the empire. They only care to save from destruction the individual ownership of dwelling houses, of land, of factories in any case, but at least of dwelling houses and the capital that is necessary for manufacturing. And labor notes would just answer the purpose of upholding this private property. As long as labor notes can be exchanged for jewels or carriages, the owner of a house will willingly accept them for rent. And as long as dwelling houses, fields and factories belong to isolated owners, men will have to pay these owners in one way or another for being allowed to work in the fields or factories or for living in the houses. The owners will agree to be paid by the workers in gold, in paper money or in checks, exchangeable for all sorts of commodities, once that toll upon labor is maintained and the right to levy it is left with them. But how can we defend labor notes, this new form of wagium, when we admit that the houses, the fields and the factories will no longer be private property, but they will belong to the commune or the nation? Part 2. Let us closely examine this system of remuneration for work done, preached by the French, German, English and Italian collectivists, (the Spanish anarchists who still call themselves collectivists, imply by collectivism the possession in common of all instruments of production and the liberty of each group to divide the produce as they think fit, according to communist or any other principles, It amounts to this. Everybody works in field, factory, school, hospital, etc. The working day is fixed by the state, which owns the land, the factories, the roads, etc. Every work day is paid for with a labor note, which is inscribed with these words, 8 hours work. With this check, the worker can procure all sorts of merchandise in the stores owned by the state or by diverse corporations. The check is divisible, so that you can buy an hour's work worth of meat, 10 minutes worth of matches, or half an hour of tobacco. After the collectivist revolution, instead of saying 2 pence worth of soap, we shall say 5 minutes worth of soap, most collectivists, true to the distinction laid down by middle-class economists, and by Marx as well, between qualified work and simple work, tell us moreover that qualified or professional work must be paid a certain quantity more than simple work. Thus, 1 hour's work of a doctor will have to be considered as equivalent to 2 or 3 hours' work of a hospital nurse, or to 3 or 5 hours' work of a navy. Professional or qualified work will be a multiple of simple work, says the collectivist Grönlund, because this kind of work needs a more or less long apprenticeship. Some other collectivists, such as the French Marxists, Guest, do not make this distinction. They proclaim the equality of wages. The doctor, the schoolmaster, and the professor will be paid in labor checks at the same rate as the navy. 8 hours visiting the sick in a hospital will be worth the same as 8 hours spent in earthworks or else in mines or factories. Some make a greater concession. They admit that disagreeable or unhealthy work, such as sewerage, could be paid for at a higher rate than agreeable work. 1 hour's work of a sewerman would be worth, they say, 2 hours of a professor's work. Let us add that certain collectivists admit of corporations being paid a lump sum for work done. Thus a corporation would say, here are 100 tons of steel, 100 workmen were required to produce them, and it took them 10 days. Their work day being an 8-hour day, it has taken them 8,000 working hours to produce 100 tons of steel, 8 hours a ton. For this the state would pay them 8,000 labor notes of 1 hour each, and these 8,000 cheques would be divided among the members of the iron works as they themselves thought proper. On the other hand, 100 miners having taken 20 days to extract 8,000 tons of coal, coal would be worth 2 hours a ton, and the 16,000 cheques of 1 hour each received by the guilds of miners would be divided among their members according to their own appreciation. If the miners protested and said that a ton of steel should only cost 6 hours work instead of 8, if the professor wished to have his day paid 4 times more than the nurse, then the state would interfere and would settle the differences. Such is, in a few words, the organization the collectivists wish to see arise out of the social revolution. As we see, their principles are collective property of the instruments of production, and remuneration to each according to the time spent in producing, while taking into account the productivity of his labor. As to the political system, it would be the parliamentary system modified by positive instructions given to those elected and by the referendum, a vote taken by noes or ayes by the nation. Let us own that this system appears to us simply unrealizable. Collectivists begin by proclaiming a revolutionary principle, the abolition of private property, and then they deny it no sooner than proclaimed, by upholding an organization of production and consumption which originated in private property. They proclaim a revolutionary principle and ignore the consequences that this principle will inevitably bring about. They forget that the very fact of abolishing individual property in the instruments of work, land, factories, road, capital, must launch society into absolutely new channels, must completely overthrow the present system of production, both in its aim as well as in its means, must modify daily relations between individuals as soon as land, machinery, and all other instruments of production are considered common property. They say no private property, and immediately after strive to maintain private property in its daily manifestations. It shall be a commune as far as regards production, fields, tools, machinery. All that has been invented up till now, factories, railways, harbors, mines, etc., all are yours. Not the slightest distinction will be made concerning the share of each in this collective property. But from tomorrow, you will minutely debate the share you are going to take in the creation of new machinery, in the digging of new mines. You will carefully weigh what part of the new produce belongs to you. You will count your minutes of work, and you will take care that a minute of your neighbor's should not buy more than yours. And as an hour measures nothing, as in some factories a worker can see to 6 power looms at a time, while in another he only tends to, you will weigh the muscular force, the brain energy, and the nervous energy you have expended. You will accurately calculate the years of apprenticeship in order to appraise the amount each will contribute to future production. And this, after having declared that you do not take into account his share in post-production. Well, for us it is evident that a society cannot be based on two absolutely opposed principles, two principles that contradict one another continually, and a nation or a commune which would have such an organization would be compelled to revert to private property in the instruments of production, or to transform itself into a communist society. Part 3. We have said that certain collectivist writers desire that a distinction should be made between qualified or professional work and simple work. They pretend that an hour's work of an engineer, an architect or a doctor must be considered as 2 or 3 hours' work of a blacksmith, a mason or a hospital nurse, and the same distinction must be made between all sorts of trades necessitating apprenticeship and the simple toil of day laborers. Well, to establish this distinction would be to maintain all the inequalities of present society. It would mean fixing a dividing line from the beginning between the workers and those who pretend to govern them. It would mean dividing society into two very distinct classes, the aristocracy of knowledge placed above the horny-handed lower orders, the one doomed to serve the other, the one working with its hands to feed and clothe those who, profiting by their leisure, study how to govern their fosterers. It would mean reviving one of the distinct peculiarities of present society and giving it the sanction of a social revolution. It would mean setting up as a principle an abuse already condemned in our ancient crumbling society. We know the answer we shall get. They will speak of scientific socialism. They will quote bourgeois economists, and Marx too, to prove that a scale of wages has its raison d'être. as the labor force of the engineer will have cost more to society than the labor force of the navy. In fact, have not economists tried to prove to us that if an engineer is paid 20 times more than a navy, it is because the necessary outlay to make an engineer is greater than that necessary to make a navy? And has not Marx asserted that the same distinction is equally logical between two branches of manual labor? He could not conclude otherwise, having taken up on his own account Ricardo's theory of value and upheld that goods are exchanged in proportion to the quantity of work socially necessary for their production. But we know what to think of this. We know that if engineers, scientists or doctors are paid 10 or 100 times more than a laborer, and if a weaver earns 3 times more than an agricultural laborer, and 10 times more than a girl in a match factory, it is not by reason of their cost of production, but by reason of a monopoly of education or a monopoly of industry. Engineers, scientists and doctors merely exploit their capital, their diplomas, as middle-class employers exploit a factory, or as nobles used to exploit their titles of nobility. As to the employer who pays an engineer 20 times more than a laborer, it is simply due to personal interest. If the engineer can economize £4,000 a year on the cost of production, the employer pays him £800. And if the employer has a foreman who saves £400 on the work by cleverly sweating workmen, he gladly gives him £80 or £120 a year. He parts with an extra £40 when he expects to gain £400 by it. And this is the essence of the capitalist system, the same differences obtained among different manual trades. Let them, therefore, not talk to us of the cost of production, which raises the cost of skilled labor, and tell us that a student who has gaily spent his youth in a university